Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gudolf Zinterberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Christopher Sorrentino. He's the author of the novel The Fugitives, recently published by Simon & Schuster. To my mind, it was a fascinating novel because it was so many kinds of novels at once. It was a true crime story as narrated by a journalist, a novel of over-the-top emotion as told by a sensitive writer, a novel involving folktales, Indian folktales, as told by a man who might possibly not be an Indian and might not exist at all. And the tones of voice throughout the book make for different kinds of novels, so that by the end of the book, there's a resolution. But while we're reading, we're involved in a novel that's going deeply into the mind of each of the major characters. Yeah?
Yeah. There's definitely an emphasis on interiority, most obviously with the first narrator of the book, or I should say the second, the first being our Native American folktale storyteller. But the dominating perspective is from Sandy Mulligan, my sensitive writer, and its subjectivity is something that I was trying for the first time. I'd never really written in any sustained way in a first-person voice, and I wanted to get as far inside of him and what he was thinking as I possibly could.
Well, this man whose name is Sandy Mulligan, he is, we come to learn, an inveterate liar, a pathological liar. So he takes us into his personal world. But we find out from others that he's been leaving out certain important facts, like the woman who he had an adulterous affair with, that she committed suicide. We've heard all about this affair, except its effect on her. And he's been making himself sound like a man taking very good care of his exes, except when it's not convenient for him to do so. So what we find out is that, once again, a novel is a slippery thing, and that the truth that a character in a novel tells lasts only as long as he's there to tell it.
That was definitely the thing I was most interested in exploring. I should give a little bit of background here. There's certain genre of novel that I refer to as old men writing their memoirs in a room. And I've always been fascinated by them and had been reading them oddly in succession of one another. And these books go, I guess, back to maybe Dostoevsky and his Underground Man. And then there's Machado de Assis and his Dom Casmurro. And there's, of course, Ford Madox Ford and John Dowell. and so on and so forth, right up through Beckett and Bernhardt's narrators. And
Wait, who's John Dowell?
John Dowell is the narrator of The Good Soldier.
I never knew his name.
Yes.
It's thought to be the most famous, unreliable narrator in the literature of the 20th century. That's so carefully constructed that even years after you've read and reread the book, you can't tell when the narrator is telling the truth.
No, you don't know what actually happened in that book. And I think that's what I wanted to take off from, were these books in which the narrators are simultaneously self-impugning, so that you have an inkling as the reader that you're not being dealt with 100% straight, but at the same time, there's not really any kind of wink on my part as the author to let you know this is actually the authoritative truth. And I think that's what I succeeded with this book, was reading these guys, and they're mostly guys, I will admit to it, and trying to take from them that sense both of unreliability, but also that sense that since we're only getting the story from them, that we're obliged to hang on to their every word because it's the only lifeline we have. The mix, of course, then you brought it up with your first question, is in the presence of Kat, my secondary narrator, who we meet through a close third-person perspective. And then finally, in the penultimate section of the book, a kind of omniscient third-person narrator who seems to be clearing up a lot of the questions that the first two narrators may have placed in our minds for us.
Well, it's very interesting because both that unreliable narrator, Sandy, and Kat are both, neither of them would be offended exactly if we met them and said, you're a sex addict, right? Pure and simple. Now, I thought it would be very interesting to hear a little bit of Sandy, because this is a section where this had better be sincere or it's nothing, and yet it's only sincere while you read it. He's thinking about his father's death, that he hasn't really given himself enough time to mourn it. This is from The Fugitives by my guest, Christopher Sorrentino.
Let him live. Let him live and I'll do whatever you want. Let him live and I'll be good. Let him live and I'll live without ambition, without greed, without lust, without envy, without pride. I'll live as a wraith or a saint. The patient father, the perfect husband, the devoted son I have not been. Let him live and I'll accept poverty. Let him live and I'll accept my own illness and death. And even as I pledged these things, I inserted, as I once had done while working as an insurance underwriter, various exclusions, escape clauses from these obligations. I will do what you want, but not consider devout observance or worship. I will be good, but reserve the right to define that term for myself. I'll have no ambition, but will continue devotedly to pursue my work. No greed, but I will strive after what I feel is due me. No lust, but in my heart. No envy or pride, but that to which I am entitled. A wraith or a saint, but one who eats and drinks and walks the earth as a man. The patient father, except when engrossed or otherwise engaged. The perfect husband, but ever cognizant of my wife's flaws. The devoted son, but still 1,000 miles away and much too busy to call. I would accept poverty, but not court it. My own illness, but not a serious illness. My own death, but at a suitably old age, compos mentis and surrounded by family, and with time to put my affairs in order. In the end, the bargain I attempted to strike with God was no bargain at all, certainly not one I would have accepted if I were the creator of the universe, and appropriately enough, God destroyed my father, and in retaliation, or at least I've come to think of it as retaliation, I destroyed my own life. It was only weeks after returning from that visit that I began my affair with Susanna, as if I intended to show God exactly how angrily disobedient I could be. God already would have known, of course. God would say, free will, champ, or the occasion of sin, champ. He had his own exclusions in place.
That was Christopher Sorrentino reading from his novel, The Fugitives. Now, as you heard, the beginning of that sounds a plaintive note. Let him live and I'll give up everything. Here, these characters are involved in a kind of ongoing ambivalence. They know that they're living in a world which has already betrayed them. It goes without saying, this sensitive writer is thinking of his editor and his agent in New York in a publishing world that's already on the skids. He's already just about past his deadline. He's going to be sued to get his advance back. Nothing is going to work out for these characters. And so, in his case, he invents a forgiving God.
Well, he invents a forgiving God and then begins to backtrack on all the promises he makes to the God, which I think is also very typical for those kinds of foxhole prayers. The thing about these characters is life has let them down, but in a greater sense, they've let themselves down, all of them. And I count the central characters, of course, are the titular, the eponymous fugitives. But everyone in the book is, in a sense, a fugitive because everyone, in a sense, has done what life expected of them. They've all conformed, in a sense, followed the rules, in a sense, in order to attain what they've attained or to escape from the initial situation that they felt was binding them, and have felt betrayed by their having followed those rules, as I think a lot of people do. Where we find them is in that moment of crisis at which they have then torn themselves free of that constraint that they had begun to resent and feel angry about. And what I'm suggesting, I guess, in the book is that this is behavior that's, for these characters at least, pathological. I think Sandy's going to go on and continue. He's going to continue to mislead us right through the final words of the book. I think Kat's going to continue to do as she does once she's decided that Sandy's not worth spending much more time with. And I think all the other characters implicitly are stuck in this kind of rigged game that they've committed to but don't feel the emotional or moral force that would bind them to that commitment in a more positive way.
Well, Christopher Sorrentino, I have a theory about this book. Can I try it on you?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear it.
That for the first, three-quarters of the book, we're dealing with the characters and their shadows. We're told in the book that without shadows, these people are cartoons. In fact, cartoons, it's pointed out, have no shadows. Then the characters who've reached a point of unbearable irresolution surrender their interiority, and we enter a cartoon with them by the end of the book. The cartoon happens to be a true crime story involving an Indian casino, guns and thefts and midnight car pursuits. But the book is saying this novel cannot continue to be written at the voltage of the privacy of these characters. We're going to retreat into noir, which is a joke because noir, of course, means black. It's famous for its shadows, but it's a noir without shadows. It's a noir without the insides of the characters. Yes? No? Part?
Sort of. the thing that you're absolutely right about is that what I wanted, once we'd gotten, say, I think it's about 200 pages into the book with Kat and Sandy kind of trading sections and each of them becoming more and more evidently not 100% on the up and up, I realized that I needed to bring the book to some kind of resolution. And one way to bring the book to a kind of resolution was by removing it, as you said, from their hands. So what I was attempting to get across was that the book had, in effect, been shanghaied from its narrators and delivered into the hands of someone who could speak authoritatively about this story. Unfortunately, apart from those gestures, and this is unfortunate, I guess, to the readers who really demand a kind of categorical determination of whether what they're reading is true or not, there's never any categorical moment where the book says, this is it, folks. This is the part of the book that you can believe. A lot of people have their theories. My girlfriend said, I know which part is true. And I'm like, don't tell me, because I don't want to contradict you or say what?
But you see, what I think is that section you read, beginning, let him live, and I'll do whatever you want, these are attempts to grab the book by the collar and say, it's mine. I'm going to have a soliloquy now. I'm going to beg for my father's life. The father's already dead when this is presented. Yeah. This isn't an honest plea in any way. He is always fighting for control of a novel that he has already, what would you say, surrendered. He's moved away from New York. He's living in Michigan.
Michigan.
What's the town?
The town they invented is called Cherry City. It's based on a town called Traverse City that I know very well, but I wanted to change it so that I could make alterations to it with impunity.
And he has no real connections there. He's gone there to hide, ostensibly to write this book. But he's stopped being able to write because he's brought his life into so much turmoil. We learn, but not from him, that the woman he's been most recently involved with is a suicide. He's probably in whatever passes, whatever replaces mourning because of his responsibilities in this death. So he's not there to write a book. He's there to escape from his prior life, during which he was already failing to write the book. He probably had the affair in order to avoid the book as well. Yes? No?
Well, I think Sandy finds himself, like a lot of writers, not quite sure what to do when the actual prospect of writing presents itself. I mean, an interesting thing about living in New York City, which I do, is that the life of an author is really bifurcated from the life of a writer. And if you have any kind of success as an author, it takes you a while to reorient yourself to the job of taking your actual writing life seriously.
And are you saying that success destroys a writer?
I'm not saying that success destroys a writer. What I'm saying is that one often mistakes the two for each other. And to get back to the work of writing, particularly when your life has been complicated in the sorts of ways that Sandy's complicated his life, is difficult and sometimes torturous. And I think that Sandy's life is particularly difficult. He set up, as I think you suggested, a lot of ways for himself to be able to say, well, of course I can't write a book. My marriage is breaking up. Of course I can't write a book. I have this tragic love affair to deal with. Of course I can't write a book because all these people are saying these terrible things about me. And so he doesn't write the book. And yet that doesn't stop him on any ethical or moral level from accepting tremendous amounts of money from his publisher to write this book.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Christopher Sorrentino about his book, The Fugitives. We'll continue after this short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Christopher Sorrentino about his latest book, The Fugitives, the story of three people hoping to hide and disconnect only to find themselves completely enmeshed. Now, there's a certain level on which each of these characters is and isn't what's being presented. Kat is a woman of Indian origin who has been passing. She's gotten herself an education at the University of Ann Arbor. She's working as a journalist. She does not refer to herself as a Native American. Probably she would not lie, but she does not say who she is. She's not a creature of indigenous pride. Compared to Sandy, she's a saint. Because among the things that Sandy does not tell us about what people are saying about him is that the woman who committed suicide was pregnant. I mean, we're really at that point ready to say he's reprehensible. Probably we have to do a lot of backpedaling at that moment. We have to understand that probably that woman did not tell him she was pregnant, that probably he was so disconnected even in that affair that she was keeping secrets from him as monumental as the secrets he keeps from others. And our third character, who is a storyteller, he's a Native American storyteller. He goes and tells stories of spirits and animal totems to children at libraries, to people at town barbecues. He may not be anything at all, but he seems to have been someone who participated in a huge theft at an Indian-run casino. Now, tell me, I know the answer for other writers, but for you, what is the attraction of writing about reprehensible people?
Well, I think it's not so much reprehensible people I'm attracted to. It's more like people who are slippery. I talk about this with my students all the time. I say the interesting thing about being a novelist, the interesting thing about writing fiction is that it, on its face, it disregards all of the things that we think of as being the virtues of writing. We think of writing as being well-organized. We think of writing as being something that makes an argument and supports that argument with evidence and then restates the argument in the form of a conclusion. And I think what novelists do is they will present you with a whole slew of ambiguities and a whole lot of characters about whom you begin to get the sense that the authors themselves are ambivalent about them, even as you are forming your own ambivalent opinions about them. And you're often left with a lot of contradictory information and big holes in that information that you're supposed to sort of build bridges between in order to form your interpretation of the book. And this was the book where I thought I would have an opportunity to do that to my heart's content. And that's what interested me far more than Sandy as a reprehensible character.
Nothing is necessarily the final truth. That's its art.
Nothing is the final truth except for the fact that all of these people, I mean, I'm willing to go this far, which is to say that the final dialogue by the storyteller, and I won't say much more than that because I think that actually would be a spoiler, is one that I think that we can take at face value. I think that's something that's supposed to come direct from the powers that be out there in the great beyond. And I think that that's a place where we actually see the evidence of everybody else's mendacity put into a kind of relief. And
well, it's kind of amazing because throughout the book, we've been getting, usually at night, visions from above looking down. And so this narration by the universe itself has been on display throughout the book.
I take it that you're referring in part to the kind of timeless Native American stories that serve to punctuate the book.
And but also landscape. The landscape, the stars, the constellations in the book. There's constantly a kind of reference that the world, that the universe is larger than the world of just these characters.
Well, that's part of what those stories are, too. I mean, those are stories that are drawn from a culture that was well aware of its relationship to nature and well aware of the ways that nature was not terribly interested in their well-being. And most of the stories that Salto, the storyteller, tells are about Nanobozo, the trickster. And tricksters are interesting because what they do is they pretty much illustrate to anybody who thinks that they are in command of their own fate or that their clever manipulation or maneuver to place themselves an advantage is going to work. Nanobozo's function is to say, no, not so much. Here's how we're going to mess this up for you. And I really got interested in him because that's precisely what his spirit, if not his actual appearance, manages to do to each of the characters in this book who thought they had it all together, who thought that their stories were together, that their ruses and their ways of presenting themselves were unassailable. And in the end, no, nothing was unassailable. The truth came out, if not for the characters in the book, for the readers who were looking at them.
Well, I think that in the same way that you drew a distinction between an author and a writer, I think there's a distinction in this book between a trickster and a liar.
Well, a trickster has a kind of holy mission.
Yes.
And a liar is a liar is a liar, I guess.
I think it's your best book, Christopher.
Thank you, Michael.
I have been talking with Christopher Sorrentino, author of The Fugitives, recently published by Simon & Schuster. It's been a pleasure to see you.
You too. Nice to be back here.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Fugitives at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Helen MacDonald is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.